docket is Curtis Leon Finley versus Commonwealth. Ms. Burrows and Mr. Whitmer, have you all signed in?
I have not.
Go ahead and sign in so we can keep track of you.
If I could reserve 2 minutes, please.
Okay, 2 minutes it is.
Ms. Burrows, before you begin, may I clear something up with you?
Certainly.
And just to give you the backdrop, we heard this morning about KFC, yet we were provided no chicken. You referenced a cake in your brief. Is this a cake that we'll actually get to see, touch, or taste?
I was concerned with trying to bribe the court, so I decided not to bring cake this morning. I apologize. I can brief the court with cake if that would be acceptable.
Maybe Mr. Whitmer brought a cake.
I don't want to eat that cake.
Good morning, judges. My name is Joan Burrows. I'm representing Mr. Finley this morning. We're here asking the court to reverse his convictions and find that the trial court's denial of his motion for discovery pursuant to Brady was incorrect. Your Honors, I think this is a fairly straightforward case. There are three elements to a Brady violation. I think each and every one of those elements is met here, and for that reason, I would ask the court to reverse. First and foremost, the evidence in question needs to be favorable and exculpatory. I can't imagine a case where this information that was redacted from by the Commonwealth would have been any more exculpatory. The information that was redacted essentially prevented Mr. Finley from going out and finding evidence that would have cemented and bolstered his self-defense claim. There can be no more exculpatory evidence than evidence that would go to a defendant's defense. And certainly, any time a person is accused of acting violently or committing murder, as in this case, they are entitled to present evidence of the victim's prior propensities for violence. And that's exactly the kind of information that we could have gotten, or that the trial counsel could have gotten, had that information not been redacted in the Commonwealth's response. So certainly the evidence in question was favorable, and it certainly was exculpatory.
Counsel, you had the names, correct?
We had the names, and that's all we had.
The judge gave you other information, correct, or other ability to obtain or to find those individuals, correct?
Well, the judge gave counsel a continuance and gave counsel money for an investigator. I would submit to this court that the judge could have given him another year and could have given him, 10 investigators. That's not going to get you the information that we need that was redacted from this report.
What is exculpatory about 8 East Elm Street?
What's exculpatory is finding the person who lives at 8 Elm Street.
Well, that may or may not be exculpatory. We don't know what that person is going to say if you find them. And the Commonwealth cites Kyles versus Whitley for the proposition that the Constitution is not violated every time the government fails or chooses not to disclose evidence that might prove helpful to the defense. To establish a Brady violation, don't you have to show me that the address would have been helpful?
No, I think that when you look at the Workman case and the cases cited therein, you don't have to prove that the evidence was... obviously, if the evidence itself is exculpatory, that's the A-plus here. But when you have evidence like this that could lead to exculpatory evidence, I think Workman stands for the proposition that that type of evidence needs to be turned over.
So just a scintilla of a possibility is enough?
Well, I don't think we're operating with more than a scintilla here, because we have this information that says these people were involved in a very violent interaction with the victim. And so I think it stands to reason that these people are going to have some information that would be very helpful and exculpatory to Mr. Finley.
But the names were not redacted.
Correct.
Only the addresses.
Only their contact information.
Correct.
Was it current contact information, or was it contact information from a number of years ago?
We don't know. And I think that's...
You know when the police report was created, don't you?
Certainly.
So it may not have even been current contact information.
But the problem is we don't know the answer to that question because the Commonwealth withheld it. What we're left with are names. And looking at the names that are included in here, even the most individualized name, In the city of Richmond, you're not a name more than anything, just a name is not going to get you to that person. And by just turning over their names, certainly the Commonwealth had an intention for us to be able to find them, but then withholds the information that they clearly have that would help us to find them. And so I think that in and of itself, it was obstructionist. And any argument that the Commonwealth would have that these people had a right to privacy is completely undercut by the fact that they gave the names. If they were concerned about privacy or concerned about these victims being contacted, they shouldn't have given the names at all. I would still have a problem with the fact that they didn't give the names, but I think that undercuts their argument.
Ms. Burrs, you are not trial counsel. Am I correct on that?
That is correct.
Can we take it to the next step? And let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we would agree that it's exculpatory or could possibly or even likely be exculpatory. What are we to do when it gets to the point of trial and there is nothing done by the defendant or counsel to indicate to the trial court that, no, we did not have enough time or the resources necessary to get the information we need to prepare a defense in this case, and that even beyond that, we are ready for trial today? How do we get beyond that?
Well, I think we have to look at the fact that they made the Brady motion. The concerns that were brought up in the motion were the exact same concerns that we still have, which is that this information essentially leaves us in an impossible situation. We're not able to find these people. That's not going to change because we were never given their addresses. So I think, and based on
when the trial court crafted its remedy for that, I don't think that was the trial court's assumption, that it would be impossible to find them.
But the trial court still made the ruling that that information was not going to be turned over. And I think that's the issue we have, is that the ruling did not make the Commonwealth turn that information over, and that's the problem that we have with
this. You have the Brady violation, you have the circuit court's remedy, then you have the are you ready for trial, and the answer is yes.
Well, I think the flip side of that is, are we now, as a defense counsel, required to make two separate Brady motions? We come to the court and say we can't find this information. Is the court saying that defense counsel is then required to come back and say, that information I told you I couldn't find, I still can't find it?
Well, we'd be in a different posture then in terms of the appellate argument, because then counsel would have acted on the court's, giving you the continuance and the ability to go out and scour and see if you can find these individuals, and then you come back to the court and say, no, I can't.
I think
the Commonwealth's refusal to give it to us has made it impossible for us. Will you revisit that?
Well, I think the problem is that all of that information was brought up during the original Brady motion. Now, certainly had counsel come back and made those representations, that would have been helpful, but I think for the purposes of this court to review it and purposes of preservation, the Brady motion that he made originally was sufficient. And I think to ask him to make it a requirement that he come back and essentially make a second motion, that's placing the burden on the defendant, and that's not appropriate given that this is a criminal context.
But is the trial judge on notice that his suggested solution didn't work? Hypothetically, you hire the investigator, you find all these people, and they don't say anything helpful. What is defense counsel going to do differently other than, he's not going to come in and say they're not helpful. So the answer to that question, are you ready for trial, would have simply been yes.
But I think we have to look at the fact that regardless of whatever remedy the trial court attempted to craft, they still denied our request that this information be turned over. And that's what we're alleging error on here. And so I think the standard requires us to look at that failure and to decide whether that information is exculpatory, whether it was withheld, and whether it was material. And so while defense counsel certainly could have done more things to remediate this, the bare minimum is that he made his motion. He put the court on notice that this was going to be problematic. And I think it bears out in the evidence. The only evidence that was presented out of all of these all of these police reports was an accidental homicide. There's no information presented about the assaults. There's no information presented about the robbery. So I think that concern that he was unable to track these people down is borne out in the evidence.
Was any attempt made to call the police officers?
I'm not sure about that, but again, that first and foremost, I think, again, you're placing the burden on the defendant. That's not the defendant.
Well, under Brady, you've got, you do have a burden to prove prejudice, to prove, that it's exculpatory. I mean, there's burdens on the defendant with regard to Brady.
There are, once there has been a Brady violation alleged, but to say that we have to go out and find these police officers, I think is
Well, the judge didn't find a Brady violation.
Correct.
The judge just took an alternative means by which to provide the opportunity to chase these folks down.
Well, actually, I'm going to I think him saying that this evidence is not exculpatory is him finding that there was no Brady violation, to be clear. Sorry.
Right.
And so, but I think even looking at if they did go out and call these police officers, the Commonwealth is treated as a whole when it comes to Brady issues. So I don't think the defense counsel would have any reasonable basis to believe that if the Commonwealth's attorney is not turning over the information, that the police officers are going to turn over that information. Well, and so even going and speaking to the police officers, there's no admissible evidence that's going to come out of that conversation.
But to establish prejudice, that finding this person would definitely help your case, going and talking to the police officer, finding out more information about it, and then you come back and when the trial court says, are you ready, you say, we're not ready because we don't have the addresses that let us find these people. And the police officers say that if we could have the actual victims, we'd get X, Y, and Z in testimony.
But I think you're asking defense counsel to look into a crystal ball and to go above and beyond what is required. And you also have to look at this in the context of this is a defense counsel trying to prepare for a murder jury trial. So to ask him to go out and do all of these auxiliary things to lead to what he knows is going to be a dead end is asking too much.
How does he know that?
He knows that in talking to the police officers, there's no admissible evidence that's going to come out of it, and there's no reason to believe that if the Commonwealth's attorney is not giving this information, that the police officer is going to give this information.
How does he know getting the addresses from years-old police reports is going to lead to anything fruitful? I mean, if you're allowed to make that assumption, that talking to the police officers won't give you anything fruitful, why can't we make the assumption that getting an old address wouldn't lead to anything fruitful?
I think we're allowed to make that assumption because you're still up against the fact that the Commonwealth had that information. We're dealing with it's when Donald Rumsfeld talked about known knowns and unknown unknowns. We have a known unknown here. We know that the Commonwealth has this information. We don't know what the police officers are going to tell us or what they're not going to tell us. And it still comes back to the fact that I don't think that that is an appropriate burden to place on the defendant when he is on trial for his life. I don't think that the statute is required, and I don't think that it is appropriate for this court to hold that he has to go that far to remedy something that the Commonwealth did wrong. So.
Well, the judge didn't find that the Commonwealth did anything wrong. The judge gave this continuance and the additional ability to chase these folks down, probably, in fact, because it was a murder case and because the defense was being given every opportunity, but the court did not find that the Commonwealth had violated Brady because the court did not find that it was exculpatory.
Correct, and that's the problem that we have. That's the error that we are alleging, is this information was certainly going to lead to exculpatory evidence. So I realize my time is running short. I will just leave the...
Just trying to follow up on something Judge Russell brought up a little bit earlier, and I know that you are arguing what you have before you the same way we have what we have before us, but we have a trial court that did not initially find that there's any sort of Brady violation, offered a remedy that the court thought might bring about successful investigation at that point in time, appointed a private investigator, gave funds for that, and said, if you need anything further, come back and see me, basically. And to Judge Russell's point, nobody came back to see him. So just thinking about this from a trial court's perspective, if I offer those remedies, and then we get down to the date of trial, and in between trial and on the morning of trial, nobody has told me that, look, it's an insurmountable burden for us to try to track down people without some hint as to what their address is so we can follow up on these leads. We've talked to the police officers. They will offer nothing. The Commonwealth is offering nothing further. We have reached complete stone walls, and we're simply not ready for trial today. We need this information from the Commonwealth, or we need an indefinite amount of time and resources available for us to try to track down these people without any leads whatsoever. No, sir, we're not ready for trial today. Doesn't, like Judge Decker said, that put us in a very different framework when we're up here, when that remedy's been requested and the trial judge has been put on notice that, wait a second, all these things that I tried to do didn't happen.
Certainly.
Because if I'm the trial judge and nobody said a word and said they're ready for trial today, what is my assumption going to be? Is that I gave enough, I did enough, and they couldn't find out anything useful.
Right. And again, that's the framework that as an appellate counsel I would prefer to have. But that's not what happened. And I think that we still are left with the fact that the judge said that this information is not exculpatory, you're not going to get it. Counsel said at the Brady motion, this is an impossible task, and I think to require him to come back and essentially make a second motion, while, again, that would be preferable, that's not what happened, I don't think it absolves the Commonwealth from its responsibility to turn this over. So.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Judge Deckard. May it please the Court. Stephen Whitmer here on behalf of the Commonwealth today. There's a huge difference between perceived futility and futility that is demonstrated after an effort has been made. The defense may perceive something to be futile, but having been given investigatory resources, they have an obligation to at least make the attempt and then come back to the trial court and say, Your Honor, we've done our best. We can't find this. All right. The suggestion that this was a futile remedy offered by the trial court is simply not supported by the record. If this court looks at the incident reports, it will see the incidents, two of the incidents took place on school property. All right. You have the names of potential witnesses. Who were the potential witnesses in a school? Teachers, students. A private investigator can go. He can look at the school yearbooks. He can find out, you know, which residences in the neighborhood have families with children of that last name. He can go knock on doors. That's what investigators do. Another one took place in a residential setting. Who are the most likely witnesses? People in that neighborhood. How many people in that neighborhood are going to have a particular last name? It's going to be a comparatively small number. The set of people who have to be combed through in the abstract is large, but in reality, if common sense is used to narrow the subset of likely witnesses, it's small.
Hypothetically, let's assume for a moment that 8 East Elm Street is in and of itself exculpatory. Then the futility, the failure to hire the utilize the investigator is irrelevant, isn't it?
No, not at all. Not at all. That would be Moreno, Your Honor. It's very clear that in the event of a Brady violation, the trial court has discretion to determine what the appropriate remedy is. And that remedy, you know, the remedies available to a trial judge are broad indeed. In this case, this is the remedy selected by the trial judge. And I would suggest that the trial judge may have thought that there was something helpful for the defense here, but that the trial judge correctly recognized that addresses and telephone numbers are not in and of themselves admissible to demonstrate that the defendant did not commit the crime or that the defendant was acting in self-defense. They might be helpful, but they might not. So the trial judge made the correct decision in finding they were not exculpatory, but went ahead and granted the defendant a remedy anyway. The idea that there is a terrible burden placed on the defendant to keep track of changing circumstances or to apprise the trial court of a change in circumstances in trial is simply unsupported by any authority. In every capital case, well, nearly every capital case, we see a motion for a change of venue. And in most cases, what the trial judge says is, I'm going to deny the motion at this time. And then months or even years go by, and we go to trial, and the defense doesn't renew the motion. If the defense doesn't renew the motion, it's waived. Even though the prosecution in the meantime may have held numerous press conferences, and there may have been inflammatory media coverage since the date of the original motion. This is a very analogous situation to that.
Could the Commonwealth have withheld the names of the complaining witnesses? That said, you have the police reports, you have where they occurred, I'll give you an investigator, go try to find them.
I would suggest that the Commonwealth could have, but the Commonwealth didn't. And there's just really no reason this court has to go in, you know, down that road in this case. The witnesses, you know, assuming they had anything to offer at all, there's nothing to lead anybody to believe that that would have been helpful. This court has to consider also, in terms of materiality, the entirety of the evidence presented at trial, if it reaches the merits of the case. This is not a case that would have lent itself to self-defense as a successful defense. This is a case where the defendant repeatedly threatened to kill the victim, went into the house in the early morning hours, had a fight, pursued an unarmed victim, and shot him in the back. Self-defense simply would have been, at best, an unlikely successful defense. And in the absence of some sort of proffer that of something that would have made a difference in that, none of these incidents speak to the sort of violence that happened in that apartment or home on that night. This court also has to look at whether those prior incidents would have been sufficiently connected to be deemed exculpatory, and I don't think there's been any showing of connection. All of these incidents in the past of the victim were more than 5 years prior to this crime. None of them involved the defendant or any of the other parties or witnesses to this case. And the one incident that is identifiable, it's very clear that the defendant was not the first one to strike a blow, and the defense did not even bother to present that, even though they certainly had that available to them. Quite simply, this is a claim the court should hold defaulted, but even if it does not apply the default, this court should find the claim without merit and affirm the conviction. We would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to give you a little extra time since Judge Atlee asked that last question at the end.
Certainly, Judge. Just briefly, I think we've spent a lot of time talking about what defense counsel could have done better. I would like to leave the court with the idea of what the Commonwealth didn't do. They didn't turn over this information, and they failed to provide what Brady promises, which is a level playing field for the defendant. And given that failure, I would ask the court to consider this a Brady violation and to overturn and remand for a new trial.
All right, counsel, we'll come